The Shaping of a Nation, an historical view of how Christianity has impacted life in the UK. Recent quotation: if these things were so large, how come everyone missed them? Why did nobody notice it? Said Her Majesty to Professor Lewis Garicano of the London School of Economics regarding our current financial situation. If things were so large, how come everyone missed them? Why did nobody notice it? Now, the Queen's question is my question that I have regarding the role of Christianity, how Christianity has impacted British public life. I think there's a massive Christian influence, which I'm going to argue for over the coming 20, 25 minutes. And it's, I suppose, as a public theologian, that's my title, I have got a vested interest in saying, that I want people not to miss these big events. My argument's going to be this, and this is without any kind of triumphalism, that Christianity has not only shaped, but founded and moulded the United Kingdom and public life in an overwhelmingly positive way. And that we today, even today, we live off that legacy, we live off that capital, you might call it. But for many reasons, this legacy and this capital has been almost airbrushed out of current thinking. What's the current view that people have of Christianity? Well, that it's irrelevant, that it's benign. You can have your faith, but as long as you keep it private, that's the main thing. Don't make it public. Then it's just an embarrassment, frankly. Or this kind of what I called a Dibley-esque vision. John Major's warm beer, long shadows on the cricket field. And of course, Orwell's quotes regarding the England that was, old maid cycling to Holy Communion. Now, I want to challenge that misperception of how people view Christianity, this privatised, regulated faith. First, I just think it's bad history to neglect the impact of Christianity on the UK, whether you think it's a good impact or not. Just to neglect it is just bad history. Secondly, though, I think it's bad thinking. Why? Because there is this perception, but it's a misconception, that faith has to be privatised from matters of public life. That's a very recent invention. And I suppose I spend my time arguing with philosophers and others that all of us bring cherished commitments to the table of public life. There's no neutral or naked public square. We all come with a view of the world which shapes what we do in the world. Whether you're a Christian, whether you're an agnostic, whether you're a Muslim, whether you're an atheist, whether you love Christians, whether you hate Christians, all of us have commitments that shape what we do in the world. So, here is my aim, to show how Christianity has impacted life in the UK, to show, here's the illustration, I suppose. Some of you may know, some of you may not, that at the coronation ceremony, the Queen was given a gift with these words: "To Your Majesty, here we present you with the Bible, the most precious gift this world affords." The most precious gift this world affords. So I want to argue why that's not just madness, that's not just pomp and ceremony gone mad. There are real reasons why the Queen was given that Bible, and why thousands and millions of people have thought that the Bible and the Christian faith is the most important gift that this world affords. So, that's my aim. I'm going to start, I think, fairly uncontroversially, but we'll move through the gears as we go on. Firstly, this. I'm going to talk about law, I'm going to talk about science, I'm going to attempt to talk about economics, and then I'm going to talk about social renewal. So, firstly, the basis of common law. Well, it's likely that within 200 years of the founding of Christianity, when Jesus Christ was alive, that Britannia, as the Romans called it, had heard of the Christian message. But it wasn't until the 6th century, with the preaching of people like Patrick to the Irish. Columba, Aidan, and of course the very famous theologian Augustine, that Christian numbers and influence increased. Now, the earliest document we have written in English is the code, the legal code of King Ethelbert, who was converted in the 6th century, and whose code was strongly influenced by Christian ideals and Christian law. And that's continued. The system that we have in this country known as common law was developed during the 12th and the 13th century, and this has been largely shaped by Christian values. You can't get away from it. In general, the legal system, which we pride still, has been shaped by Christendom. Think about those things that we take for granted, but have a very strong Christian base, normally in the sense that they were developed in the ecclesiastical church courts and then moved over into the legal sphere. Retributive justice, legal representation, the taking of oaths, judicial investigation and rules for evidence, all owe a huge debt to Christian influence. British justice, when correctly applied, let me say that, when correctly applied, has been a model of justice to the world. Lord Denning, the very famous civil rights lawyer in the 60s and 70s, famously said, if religion, and by that he meant Christianity, if Christianity perishes in the land, truth and justice will also. Now again, you might not like that, but that's just how it is. The basis of common law is due to a large dose of Christian influence, and that continues today. Secondly, the origins of modern science. What is inscribed over the door of the physics laboratory in Cambridge? Abandon your faith before you enter here? No. Physics is fun? No. Psalm 111, verse 2. Great are the works of the Lord, studied by all those who delight in them. Put there by the very famous scientist who basically created, discovered electricity, James Clerk Maxwell. The foundation of the Royal Society in the 17th century, the foundation of modern science, owes a huge debt to Christian belief. The Royal Society's, one of its mottos at the beginning was this, that it wished to demonstrate the power and wisdom, the goodness of the Creator, as it is displayed in the admirable order and workmanship of the creatures. And hundreds and thousands of scientists have done their work on the basis of their Christian faith. William Harvey, Isaac Newton, Robert Boyle, John Ray. Now remember, it's not that they just happens to be scientists and happens to be Christians, as if they compartmentalise their lives. Professor Rodney Stark argues that science could only arise in a culture dominated in a belief of a conscious, rational, all-powerful creator. With that belief, that gave the impetus to the discovery of modern science. Why? Because belief in an orderly God who creates an orderly universe sets the boundaries or the parameters for men and women to discover in an orderly way. So Christian theology, what we think about God and the world, forms the basis for what science seeks to do. So the early scientists saw themselves as unlocking the secrets of God's creation. Now, how different in the popular perception that people have today? They think that science and Christianity are enemies. Well, they're not enemies. They're not even friends. They're so inextricably connected. And I would want to argue that science depends upon Christian belief. You know, there used to be a time when people thought that weather patterns were due to the fact that the gods were arguing with each other. Christianity claims that God has created the world in an orderly way and that we are allowed to discover that. So the foundations of science, or the foundations of modern science, owe a huge debt to Christianity. Thirdly, and I take a sip of water as I'm going on to more debated ground now. The influence of Christianity as the foundation for economic growth. Now, I mean, I'm in the centre of, the financial district of the UK. I'm not an economist. But I have read some work on the influence of Christianity on economics in general. Some of you will be well aware of Weber's famous thesis in 1906, The Protestant Work Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, loved by some, hated by some, but I think actually the main tenets have not really been disputed. People have tinkered with it. And more recently, some of you may have come across, if you're interested in economic history, the monumental work by David Landis, Emeritus Professor of Economic History at Harvard, whose book, The Wealth and Poverty of Nations, Why Some Nations Are Rich and Some Remain Poor, is his magnum opus of a whole teaching career. So looking at Landis's book, this is his thesis, and I think I agree with it in many ways. Landis, I don't think, is a Christian, but he's as an economic historian, he's made the following remarks. He says this, that the takeoff to sustained continual economic growth occurred in the context of a large Christian influence in societies and on economies. Let me say that again. The takeoff to sustained continual economic growth occurred in the context of a large Christian influence in societies and on their economies. Now, he gives over hundreds and hundreds of pages how that is the case. Let me summarise his argument. Just some reasons why. Why is it that Christianity bred continued economic development? The first is this, he says, that people saw the work that they were involved with in the sacred and the secular sphere as a calling from God and to be done for God. People motivated to work hard in whatever job that they had. Not just those religious jobs like the priests and people in monasteries, but everyone. That they were to work hard because God had asked them to work hard, and that they were to do it for God's glory. So there was a motivation for people to excel and to work hard. That is, I suppose, the Protestant work ethic, to work hard. So, secular work was a calling from God. Secondly, this. The earth is subject to mankind, i.e. God had, in the Christian worldview, the Christian way of looking at things, God had given his creation, human beings made in his image, stewardship over the earth. We've already spoken about the idea of science and the orderly universe. But the idea here is that men and women could investigate and develop the potential in creation. And so what do we have in the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th century? We have the age of discovery. We have amazing inventions which led to economic growth. Landis focuses on a few of these inventions and how they were important. The water wheel, very important as we know in the Industrial Revolution. The mechanical clock, overwhelmingly important for in terms of structuring days, people could work to time. The printing press, of course. Eyeglasses, people could now work not just during daylight hours, but their eyes could be improved, they could work for longer. And then gunpowder. Why gunpowder? Well, it's very relevant in the news, because people could protect their trade lanes from pirates. Gunpowder was very important in trade getting through. And Landis makes the point that inventions were built upon inventions. He focuses on the mechanical clock in terms of the intricacy of the cogs and how that went into other inventions as well. There was development. So, secular work was according from God. The earth is subject to mankind. Thirdly, this, time is linear and valuable. That time is linear is a Christian understanding of things, of the world. Things will get better or worse. There can be change. There can be progress. Next, knowledge is valuable and universally shared. Huge literacy programs, because people wanted people to read the Bible. The Bible wasn't protected anymore. Everyone was encouraged to read the Bible. There was an encouragement to inquiry and discovery and education. Then Landis notes personal character traits. Honesty, diligence, thrift, not spending too much on yourself. Landis notes that all of these encourage sustained economic growth. And then he notices some other factors consistent with Christian faith and the worldview that the Bible sets out. Now we can get into a big political fight after this afterwards. But limited government, personal freedom, private property, equality before the law, people seen not just as citizens but as subjects. And all of these things, Landis said this: never before had these traits been characteristic of a whole society. He says, when you put all these things together that come from a Christian way of viewing the world, that is his argument for the foundations of sustained, continual economic growth. We can discuss this afterwards. Now, what I'm saying is that we take these things for granted. Time is linear. Well, of course we take that for granted. But that comes from a certain belief about the world that other views of the world perhaps don't share. So, Christianity is, I would say, at the foundations for economic growth. Then finally, the transformation of society. The transformation of society. I suppose many of you will be familiar with the Clapham sect in the 19th century, a group of Christian men and women committed to social reform. Many historians say that they really did change the moral outlook of the United Kingdom. People like Shaftesbury and Elizabeth Fry, countless others involved. Of course, the most famous person who you may have come across is William Wilberforce. Literally, the stuff of Hollywood. Remember, it was the anniversary last year and the film Amazing Grace came out. For 46 years, from 1787 to 1833, Wilberforce fought tirelessly for the abolition of the African slave trade. His bill was defeated 11 times before at 4 a.m. on February 1807, the bill finally succeeded. This is how one person at the time wrote about this. At one point, the House rose almost to a man and turned towards Wilberforce in a burst of parliamentary cheers. Suddenly, above the roar of hear, hear, and quite out of order, three hurrahs echoed and echoed while he sat, head bowed, tears streaming down his face. One eminent historian says, from any historical perspective, this was a stupendous transformation. Now, my question to you this lunchtime is this: what motivated someone like Wilberforce? What motivated someone like Wilberforce? We've said that common law was motivated by a sense of biblical ideas and ideals. We've said that science was motivated by a view of the world in which there was an orderly universe and an orderly creator. That economic growth was a view of working hard to glorify God. But what motivated someone like Wilberforce? What made him tick? Was he just a nice guy doing his best? Was he just doing it for political gain? He certainly wasn't doing it for economic benefit. And historians have remained bemused. What did he have to gain out of it? But I would like to venture that there is an easy answer to this. Because William Wilberforce, you may not know, wrote a bestseller. Better than any Geoffrey Archer, so went through hundreds and hundreds of copies. Now, the title is not the most sexy, but let me read it to you. This is the title of his bestseller: A Practical View of the Prevailing Religious System of Professed Christians in the Higher and Middle Classes in This Country, Contrasted with Real Christianity. Snappy. sold hundreds, thousands of copies at the time. It was a bestseller, literally. And in that particular work, William Wilberforce tells the reader what has motivated him for his political reform. He was driven by what he calls himself the peculiar doctrines of Christianity. The peculiar doctrines of Christianity. The good news of Christianity that Wilberforce believed was that God himself had come to earth to give hope to the world, to save the world, to save him, not because he merited being saved, but because God loved him. So Wilberforce knew that he was to be a humble man, because his new faith was not about how well he performed to earn God's favour, but he knew that he wanted to serve others because God's creation mattered, this world mattered. And he knew that he was to be a self-sacrificing person and politician, and not self-righteous and arrogant, because he believed he served a self-sacrificing God. Now, these were those peculiar doctrines of Christianity. He wasn't arrogant and proud. He wasn't holier than thou. He was humble. He wanted to serve others. And he was self-sacrificing, because he believed in a self-sacrificing God. An important thing that we need to understand is that Wilberforce was very clear, that's the whole purpose of that book he wrote, that you cannot separate the morals that drove him, his ethic, from these beliefs, these peculiar doctrines. This is what he writes in that book, A Practical View of the Prevailing Religious System of Professed Christians. He says this, he talks about the fatal habit of considering Christian morals as distinct from Christian doctrines insensibly gained strength. Thus the peculiar doctrines of Christianity went more and more out of sight, and as might naturally have been expected, the moral system itself also began to wither and decay, being robbed of that which should have supplied it with life and nutriment. What he's saying is this. If you have certain views which are in line with Christianity, but you take away the basis from which they come, those beliefs will wither and die very quickly, or they'll turn into self-righteousness, or they'll turn into arrogance. That quote, for me anyway, puts paid to the idea that you leave your own commitments when you come into the public square to argue about things. Because Wilberforce did all these things, these scientists did all these things, economies flourished and inventions happened in the public square, and those inventors did all those things because they were Christians. Because of the beliefs that they had about God and the life and the universe and everything. You can't separate those. If you kind of separated them, they wouldn't have done those things in the first place. So the view that we are to have a privatized understanding of faith in the public square is simply nonsensical. But this separation of the foundation for Christian public engagement, if that was true for Wilberforce then, how much more is true for us now? I'd like to suggest to you this lunchtime this, that many of the parts of our culture in Britain that we cherish are there because of the influence of Christianity. And that we are living off that capital, that borrowed capital, you might call it. But capital which Wilberforce would say will wither and decay and deplete without it being attached to the view of life undergirding it. These peculiar doctrines. And isn't that what we're seeing? It's funny, isn't it? When the Queen asked Professor Gary Carno that question, what was his response as to the reason for our current financial situation? And I quote, "At every stage, someone was relying on someone else and everyone thought they were doing the right thing. Where has personal responsibility gone? Thrift. People overreaching themselves. At every stage, someone was relying on someone else, and everyone thought they were doing the right thing. A sign for me, anyway, that there is that departure, that split between those beliefs that we cherish and the beliefs undergirding them. But finally, I want to finish positively and in the present by noticing that even though while many of us think that perhaps things are going pear-shaped in this country, maybe, but that continually today, even today, thousands and thousands of men and women, unheralded mainly, are getting on with transforming lives and communities based on the idea that they have been transformed by these peculiar doctrines of Christianity. I'm going to give you one example. Some of you may have come across it. A man called John Kirkby, successful businessman, whose life was transformed by these peculiar doctrines of Christianity, and who in 1996 started a debt counselling charity, Christians Against Poverty. Some of you may have heard of Christians Against Poverty. Well, this is what the Times has to say about Christians Against Poverty this year. Not only has it proved a lifeline for thousands of people losing their battle with debt, but its caring ethos extends to its employees, who are the happiest in the UK, earning Christians Against Poverty the title of Best Small Company to Work For in 2008. And I'm suggesting that there are dozens, hundreds of stories like that. And I would say, don't miss them. Don't miss them. They're out there. You may have to dig a bit, because people do have this view of Christianity that is just privatised. But every day, people are being transformed by this Christian message, and so are then transforming other lives, just like John Kirkby is, in the UK. I suppose this week you have a great opportunity to come and listen to how God has transformed people who work in this vicinity here. So, I finish by saying this, that Christianity has had not only shaped a nation, but moulded a nation. And those things that we cherish most dear are there because of these peculiar doctrines of the Christian faith. Thank you.